if we were able to truly embody the idea that our existence does not terminate when we die, that doesn't mean that life is no longer precious. It is still very precious. It's a beautiful experience that one that needs to be enjoyed and learned from. However, that is the leverage point by which systems can control us, the fear, the absolute fear of termination. And this is why I believe there is a conspiracy, if you will, to not recognize this in science, because if you have a population that is unafraid to die, they cannot be controlled. They can be controlled to some extent, but not completely. It's our connection to our body, our connection to the idea that this is all we have, is what, you know, drives us to be fearful and also drives us to hold a competitive posture with everyone around us. Because if time is limited, then of course you're going to try to outmaneuver everybody else for a bigger piece of the pie.
Welcome to Living 4D with Paul Cech. Today's guest is anesthesiologist and author Madhava Sethi. Madhava has been in clinical practice as an anesthesiologist since 2002. Closely observing thousands of patients under anesthesia led him to ask fundamental questions around ideas that have gone unchallenged for a very long time. What does it mean to be awake? Does awareness require a functioning body, or does it arise of its own? His insights into these questions and of who we are as conscious beings is the topic of his book, Woke, An Anesthesiologist's View, and also the subject of today's conversation with Paul. A big thank you to our premier sponsors, Bioptimizers, Paleo Valley, and Organifi. We could not produce this podcast without their support. And of course, Paul only works with companies whose products he loves and uses. All the sponsors offer special discounts for our listeners, so please visit the show notes page at checkinstitute.com/podcast for links and details. Or just keep listening to this episode for the featured products and offers.
Welcome to Living 4D with Paul Cech. And Madhava Sethi, I was turned on to Madhava in his excellent book, Woke, An Anesthesiologist's View, by my friend Robert Forte, who we have an excellent podcast with. Robert's an expert in the history and use of psychedelics, and Robert has been longtime friends with Madhava. And I recently read through sections of Madhava's book, but even reading the introduction, I immediately knew I had to do a podcast with him, because I think the information that he covers is something we all need to be very aware of and really consider honestly and upfront in our lives at this time. So Madhava, welcome. It's great to have this time to share with you.
Oh my goodness, Paul, it's really good to be with you, and thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. Madhava, to begin with, I always like to get the audience to get a sense of who the guest is and some connection to them. To begin with, why don't you share an overview of your life, your education, your spiritual philosophy, and what ultimately led you to writing Woke, An Anesthesiologist's View?
I am an only child to parents from South India, and I was born in this country. And I generally would characterize my childhood as being very happy, but I was very isolated and lonely. My father, I would say, is a scholar of Vedanta. And Advaita Vedanta, yes. And so I was exposed to the non-dual perspective on the world at a very young age. And I was interested in meditation and things like this. And, you know, but then again, you get caught up in high school and you move forward. And I started school a little bit early for my grade and matriculated at MIT at the age of 17, studied electrical engineering and finished in 4 years. And I was very, very fascinated by all of the possibilities. And I was being recruited to work for Wall Street, but I chose instead to work for the aerospace industry. It led to a 6-year long career. And nearing the end of that career, it was demarcated by a very interesting expedition, a scientific expedition up to the North Pole for the Office of Naval Research. And I was very lucky to be able to go on this thing because I was only 26 years old and I was working with a number of spectacularly brilliant scientists. And the objective there was to find a way to detect submarines under the ice cap. And if you're not familiar with this strategy, we pretty much know where all the nuclear subs are in the world when they're at port. And we can track them using active sonar. But every captain of every nuclear sub, as soon as they leave, they go directly to the ice cap, because once they go under the ice, we can no longer track them with active sonar. So the tactic here was to find a way mathematically and using energy sources as pings to be able to model the ice so that we could find our targets. And that would offer a tremendous tactical advantage over the Soviets. From a personal experience point of view, I was just elated to be at the top of the world. And there I was drilling large holes through the ice and laying out hydrophones and running these experiments. But the point here, Paul, is that at the end of the 7 weeks up there, it is just too expensive to bring all our equipment back to the States. So we gathered up our computers and our data, and we scuttled the rest. And whatever we didn't scuttle, we burned. And suddenly I still have this image indelibly ingrained in my mind of this pyre of burning garbage that completely desecrated this incredibly pristine scene. And at that point, I really started to question exactly what I was doing up there. And moreover, why were all of these super smart people doing what they were doing and doing what they were doing for years? Like, what is this all based on? Like, do we really have enemies exactly? And isn't there something better we can do with the talents we've been given? So from there, I went to Baylor College of Medicine. And that was another very interesting experience because I was sort of a unique student among my medical school colleagues because they were mainly coming at it from undergrad, having majored in biology or chemistry or some sort of liberal arts. Yet I was approaching the whole situation from an engineering perspective with a pretty strong background in mathematics. And it was a struggle, to be honest with you, because in engineering or physics or sciences, you have some basic principles and from which you can deduce how a system works. But when dealing with the human body, especially the way we do it in allopathic medicine, where everything is very deconstructionist and based in materialism, we found ourselves, and I would hope that most of my medical colleagues can understand this, just guessing many, many times around, you know, what exactly is going on. And that should be fairly evident, honestly, to any person in medicine, because if you have to create a drug, let's say, and give it to 1,000 people and give another 1,000 people a placebo and hope that there's some statistical difference in the benefit, you have to admit that we're just, you know, we're guessing, you know. Yeah. If we knew how it worked, then we should be able to actually create the molecule that's going to help us. But instead, we're faced with the fact that everyone's physiology is different. And we really are just scratching the surface of how this incredible material body works. Forget about the body on other planes, but just the material body is pretty much a big question. I was so frustrated with my experience in medicine. And it turned out that I wanted to be a cardiologist, and I spent a year in what's called a internal medicine residency. And I was treating people, veterans at the VA hospital, and nobody was getting better, you know, and for a number of reasons, including people just not taking their medicines. And I just became very disillusioned with internal medicine. And I was looking for a way to get back into engineering. And I was calling up my contacts back in the industry. And then a friend of mine said, from medical school, said, why don't you go into anesthesiology? Because it's very quantitative. And you're only taking care of one person at one time. And I thought, you know, why throw away a medical education? Let's give it a shot. And I've been very, very happy in this field, actually. Anesthesia, it turns out, is one of the most amazing mysteries in Western medicine. Most of the advantageous interventions that we do as allopathic physicians have to do with surgery. We've done amazing things with the scalpel and the suture, from, you know, taking out someone's appendix to fixing their broken arm to taking out an aortic valve. None of those things would be possible without modern anesthesia. And what's fascinating about anesthesia is even today, just like 25 years ago when I walked into an operating room for the first time, the very first day you're sitting there clueless and you're sitting there with an anesthesiologist, your attending physician who is teaching you the ropes. And we have these things called vaporizers, which is a sophisticated device that allows you to create a mixture of air, oxygen, nitrous oxide, and what's called your inhaled agent, your potent agent, something like ether, which we don't use anymore, but we use similar molecules. And the attending would point to the vaporizer indicating the inhaled agent and say, you know, Madhava, if you can figure out how that works, you're going to win the Nobel Prize. And the point here is that we don't know how these agents work. We know how a lot of the intravenous medications we give work, but not a gas like ether. And ether, as you know, has been around for a very long time. It's been almost 180 years since we've had ether at our disposal in our quiver. And the story goes that there was a dentist named William Morton who demonstrated the first public demonstration of anesthesia in the form of ether right here in Boston, Massachusetts, where I am, at Massachusetts General Hospital, in an auditorium. And he anesthetized a young man with a tumor on his neck. And the surgeon removed or partially removed the tumor after the young man had gone to sleep. And when he awoke, he was questioned. And when he reported that he had no signs of discomfort and he had no recollection of the experience, the physicians that were watching, most of them being surgeons, it said half of them wept because they had hardened themselves to a lifetime of hearing the agonizing screams of their patients as they operated without modern anesthesia. And to see that this could be done mercifully was almost too much for them. Fast forwarding 180 years now, we still don't know how ether works. And this is a very interesting question because most of my colleagues, in fact, all of my colleagues, we come to work and we administer these medications and we go home. They work incredibly well. I finally had paid back all of my medical school debt and I had a house and I was married and had a young son and I thought I was at the top of the world. Everything was going great. And then one day, 7 years ago, my wife showed me a video of a building that was being demolished. And I said, what? What is this? Was it a building in Vegas? What is this? And she said, no, this happened on 9/11 in Manhattan. And obviously, I'm referring to something called the Solomon Brothers Building or World Trade Center 7, which sat just 100 or 200 yards away from Ground Zero. And this is a massive, massive structure. It looks small compared to the Twin Towers, but it's a very large building, about half the height and almost twice the width. And this building fell to the ground symmetrically, uniformly, and quickly. And I had no idea that this ever happened. This is 16 years after the event. Anyway, that particular event was sort of the moment and what led to a very, very deep questioning around, forget about the world, but around my own mind and why my colleagues in engineering and structural engineering and physics could not stay in a conversation about what happened. And it was a very, very scary thing to begin with, because it is obvious that building was demolished with explosives or some other kind of, I don't know, directed energy weapon or whatever. But the point is, it did not come down from fires. And we could talk for a long time about what the proof is for something like that. But what interested me more was when I came to my friends who were mechanical engineers and knew something about physics, or even people who were building homes, you know, construction workers. At first, they were amused that I was asking questions, but when they realized that I was seriously questioning the official story, suddenly their eyes went blind and their ears went deaf and their minds closed. And that is the impetus for me in writing the book, is to deeply look at how our mind works and why are the people who should know better unable to see what's right in front of their faces.
You know, have you ever studied any of the work of Dr. Dan Siegel?
No.
Okay, well, he's an expert on the mind. He's a psychiatrist. He talks about how he went from conference to conference all over the place, all talking about the mind. And every time he raised his hand and asked, what exactly is the mind? Nobody could give him an answer. And it was such a problem for him because he felt like this was just like this terrible elephant in the room that nobody was paying attention to. He ultimately put together a team of 40 people that he really had respect for as knowledgeable, wise, deep thinkers, and they came up with a working definition of mind, which I find to be very good. But I would just like to know, when you're speaking of the word mind, what exactly are you referring to?
That's a really deep question, Paul. I would have to say, off the cuff, it would be the sequence and series of thought forms. it doesn't even have to be, you know, a physical structure. I don't think it is. Like, let's be very real here. If we look very closely, what is the source of our thoughts? The Western paradigm, of course, says that it's the product of a functioning brain. But I think you can challenge that as well.
Oh, easily. There's too many cases of hydrocephalus with 95% of the brain gone. I've even got a documented case in my library of a guy with 95% of his brain gone due to hydrocephalus with an IQ, I believe, of 111. It was very high. I mean, it was like unusually high for, it would be high for someone with a fully functional brain. This guy was, you know, worked and had kids and did his whole job. And there's many cases like that.
That's exactly
right. And so that brings up a real problem. And then another thing in that regard, just to share a little bit here, the Cray supercomputer, which is, you know, for a long time considered to be the most powerful computer in the world. I imagine there's more powerful computers now, but it uses water as the hard drive. And many of the most advanced computers in the world today are using water as their hard drive. And engineers were very curious as to how in the world you could store such massive amounts of information in water. And Greg Braden shared this in his one of his series. I can't remember exactly which one right now. But anyhow, he cited research because scientists and technologists couldn't figure out how in the hell this was possible. But what they actually found out, he cited two research studies, was that the water isn't storing the information, that the water is in resonance with a field that seems to be non-local. And that's where the information is actually going to and from. And without a long expose of the subtle energy system of the human body, you know, we have a mental field. We have a lower and a higher mental field. Lower mental field is your personal mind stuff, and the higher mental field is the archetypal realm, which Jung talks about and many others extensively. But anyhow, just to share, Dr. Daniel Siegel's definition of mind is mind and embodied and relational process that regulates the flow of energy and information. It's embodied because you're using it here. It's relational because mind is always dealing with something, right? I'm thinking about, there's the car, the tree, the math question. And it's a process because it's actually flowing and it regulates the flow of energy and information. Your mind controls, you know, as you know, tons of functions in your body, and your mind can either, you know, make your heart sick or and give you high blood pressure, or heal you and give you good blood pressure, et cetera, et cetera. We, you know, that's what placebos are for, is to show you the power of the mind, and nocebos do the same thing. But anyhow, I just thought, because we're talking about the mind, I think it's so important to really say, well, what exactly are we talking about? You know,
that's right. Yeah. Thank you for bringing it up. That's a good point. All of these things are so intimately related with the problem that we have. I'm calling this a problem, honestly, because, you know, I would surmise that your audience is totally on top of many of these things. And as I was saying to you before we went online, what you're doing is at the leading edge. And that is amazing and wonderful. However, if we truly want to make a difference in this world, we have to consider the people who are at the trailing edge.
Yes.
Right? That's how you're going to change public opinion, because that is the highest court in the land. And as much contempt as I have for a lot of the people that I've been struggling with in my own field, I realize that we have to get through to them. You know, right now in this world, there's an amazing amount of upheaval going on in terms of our understanding of what really is going on. With regards to the pandemic, for example, we have to change the mind of physicians. And with regard to 9/11, it's the structural engineers, because they're the ones that are creating the narrative. And unless we can convince them of their blind spots, we're just going to be screaming at the wind. We can be, yes, on our own islands, proclaiming on our podcast what's going on. But if we truly want to change the world, we have to get through to these people. And they're the hardest people to get through to, honestly.
Yes.
And it's because of the mind. They believe in their thoughts, for example, or they're very, very quick to jump to conclusions. And that is kind of what my book is about. It's like, how do we come to our conclusions exactly? And in order to do that, you have to slow way down. That's something that a educated and quote unquote intelligent person rarely does. They like to go at full throttle. How do we get through this problem? And as I contemplate the position I'm in compared to all of my colleagues in medicine, say, I don't know the answer to that question, but I must have to acknowledge the fact that It may be due to my upbringing.
I was going to say, because having those parental influences, I mean, you know, Vedanta is non-dual. You're already working with the awareness of the Maya of mind, and also of the awareness that there's something behind the polarized condition that creates the typical thought. So there's a deep awareness. There's something behind that isn't entangled, I would say.
And that's the part that is so important. And what a sort of quick thinking person generally does not spend any time observing. And you could call this metacognition, or a state of deep meditation where you're observing your thoughts, for example. And, you know, there's all of this, obviously there's an explosion of that sort of practice in the world right now, but there are a lot of charlatans out there as well. But I had the very good fortune of doing Vipassana. Are you familiar with that practice?
Mm-hmm. Just the basics.
It has to do with paying attention to your sensations. The Buddha felt that the deepest connection to reality is through your physical, tactile nature. And as we sort of plumb through our thoughts and ideas, like how do we know what's real and how do we know what's true? There's no denying that you're feeling a sensation if you pay attention. And your relationship with that sensation, of course, is up to you. But the existence of the sensation cannot be disputed. And really, that's one of the few things that everybody can undeniably know is true. And it's that kind of practice, I believe, that is missing from the experience that many of our scholars and spokespeople have, is how do they know what is true and what is not true? And you have to start someplace. And that is an amazing place to start, actually, because from the Buddha's perspective, it is our sensations actually that give rise to the sequence of thoughts, if you will, as opposed to the other way around. And my guess is that it goes both ways. But in any case, that was his philosophy. And that actually is why I called the book Woke, because, you know, sadly, that word has been co-opted, as we know, by a culture and vernacular that it has completely distorted what that word really means. I'm sure you know that when the Buddha was walking around northern India, people would come up to him and say, you know, holy cow, who are you? What are you? And he said, look, I'm awake. And what he meant by that, right, is that his mind was free of delusion. It's an incredible, actually, proposition which the Buddha was putting forward, is that if your mind is free of delusion, reality is compassionate.
Yes. Hello, everybody. Would you like to learn how to connect directly with your soul and highest self to gain guidance in your daily life and feel more grounded and spiritually connected? Are you ready to learn how to communicate with your soul and develop a language of direct communication that you can use to progressively develop your innate spiritual abilities, such as clairvoyance, clairsentience, clairaudience, and heightened intuition? Would you like a practical means of asking your own soul your deepest questions about all aspects of your life, life in general, or gain support from your soul in making critical decisions in your life? If you answered yes to these questions, then I have a very special offer for you. I will be offering my Tarot for Soul Guidance training program, in which I share the specific methods of using tarot as a functional language to communicate directly with your soul, as an online training program so that anyone can learn and practice in the comfort of their own home. I have deeply studied and practiced tarot for over 8 years. Additionally, I have been working directly with my soul for my own guidance and to support others in their healing and spiritual growth for over 30 years. I have taught Tarot for Soul Guidance to countless patients and students and have received amazing feedback from each of them that engage this practice. See the website for testimonials. I have chosen to offer this workshop online because I found there wasn't enough time in my previous 2-day live version for the students to digest the volume of information and practice it. My new format is specifically designed to make learning more enjoyable, easier, and give you specific practices you can work with between training sessions. This allows you to develop your skills in a step-by-step format and be able to ask all your questions so you feel grounded and confident in your tarot practice each day. Tarot for Soul Guidance will be conducted online over 7 consecutive Fridays, starting May 3rd and ending June 14th. Each 4-hour training session will run from 2 o'clock p.m. to 6 o'clock p.m. Pacific Standard Time for a total of 28 hours of training. All sessions will be recorded so students that can't make a session for any reason can study and practice when it fits their schedule. Students will be given access to session recordings for a period of time after the training ends to reinforce their new practices and skills. The course includes a comprehensive PDF manual with numerous diagrams to help students understand key concepts related to tarot theory and practice. I will explain the anatomy and practice of tarot so anyone can understand it. The training provides all you need to know to engage tarot as a legitimate spiritual practice in which you learn to maintain and deepen connection to your soul and your highest self. There are many step-by-step developmental practices you will learn so that by the time you finish the 28-hour program, you will be proficient in your practice of using tarot. You will have a language for intimate communication with your soul for daily guidance. I will teach you how to use tarot as a means of getting guidance and support from your soul in any aspect of your life, including how to gain an understanding of your future and what you may need to prepare for. Conduct a daily reading and learn ways to best manage yourself to be in harmony with your highest intentions for yourself and others. Gain information and guidance on how to make important decisions in your life. Support others through soul-guided tarot communication and how to progressively deepen your spiritual connection to your soul and highest self as a legitimate daily spiritual practice you can use anytime, anywhere. Course participants have the option to purchase the tarot deck and guidebook I recommend and use for the course directly from us with free shipping, or you can purchase the required items from another seller if you prefer. To register and see more information on the course and testimonials from those that have completed Tarot for Soul Guidance training with me, go to bit.ly/PaulCHEK workshops. That's bit.ly/PaulCHEK workshops and scroll down to the Tarot workshop offering. If you are ready to deepen your connection to your soul and your highest self, have a legitimate spiritual practice, and get support to live your dreams and be the person you came to the world to be, this workshop is for you. I look forward to seeing you in the training.
I think part of the problem is that as computing speed continues to double, like every 18 months or something like that, and computers, I'm 62, and when I was a kid, I remember when the first fax machines came out, and people thought that was miraculous, you know? When you look at, for example, what happens when people keep eating foods that have greater and greater concentrations of sugar or flavor ingredients, or you look at what happens when people are exposed to greater and greater amounts of stimuli, be it social media, even sex, your body, your neurons have a threshold. And so what happens if you keep pushing the threshold up? So you eat a normal peach and you taste it and it's very sweet. But then you start eating candy, peach candy that's flavored with chemicals to taste like peach and is loaded with sugar. Then you go give your kid the same peach and they go, oh, this doesn't taste good. They think it's bland. And Steiner called this problem supersaturation. He said that the more we stimulate ourselves sensory-wise or through emotions or mental imagery or whatever, the more our threshold has to raise up because we have to have some kind of a protective mechanism. But what ultimately happens is as we keep pushing the threshold up, in other words, it takes more and more to give me a sense of sweet or to give me a sense of sexual pleasure. Or, you know, when I was a competitive boxer, for example, the 3 weeks of the year I hated the worst is when I came in off of off season. Because after being off for a couple of months in the summertime or whenever our off season was, my body healed. But then when I would get in the boxing ring and start sparring, I just felt beat to death. But after about 3 weeks, I got to the point where I could take the hardest punch someone could throw at me and it didn't hurt. And we used to, you know, tease each other. Is that all you got? You know, we beat the shit out of each other for a living. And so
yeah,
it was very interesting for me to observe how my own body's threshold would keep rising up to where I could actually handle the trauma and no longer perceive it as trauma. Point I'm driving at is that we have a world culture now whose threshold is getting pushed higher and higher. with more and more advanced technology, more and more fear tactics, more faster speeds, more color, more light, more sound. And so what I'm pointing at is that this ability to be in touch with the witness, I call it, behind everything, is getting pushed further and further out. It's almost like a riptide is taking us out to the ocean, and we're so far out now as a race that when we look at the shore, most people say it's going to be harder to swim back to the shore than it is to just give up. And so they stop questioning things. They stop evaluating. They run to doctors for drugs or for pills. And they are always trying to figure out shortcutting and biohacking. How do I fix this thing up? Without realizing a lot of this is because you're now vibrating in a way that your cells and your systems they can't come into harmony with. So they lose any internal coherence, which means the system's always under stress and they're always seeking some kind of a band-aid and seeking it quickly, which means there's no time to actually think about, is this really true? Is there contradictory information on the other side of this? Who's involved in this? Where's the money coming from? You know, basic questions, who, what, why, where, when, and how. Most people won't answer those questions. And as you know, that's a very dangerous thing to do today. Not only are people in the state of what Steiner called supersaturation, but they're also addicted. And as you know, mm-hmm. the technology for addiction in social media is extremely effective. So it really is, for me, as much as some of these people can drive me nutty because of the way they will defend bad ideas and even hurt people over them, I really have a lot of empathy for them, because it's almost like reading the story of Plato's cave and seeing that we are now very deeply in Plato's cave. But when a wise man walks in the room and says, you guys, you know, those shadows on the wall, they're not real. Nobody believes him. And yet people are in there fighting over them shadows like they're real. And as a side note, that brings up another very serious issue. And that is, what are we going to do with all this virtual reality stuff when you got people living in other realities, and they can't even wipe their own butt, feed themselves, and get any exercise and eat real food?
Whoa. Well, look, there's so many threads in that minute and a half you just dropped there, Paul, and I don't want to lose any of them. The first thing is you brought up empathy. I would suggest that we are being prompted to not have empathy, and for good reason. And that being said, yes, you're absolutely correct with how we're being hyperstimulated. And we see this, you know, we even see it molecularly. You know, this is called tachyphylaxis, where the same dose of whatever it is does not give you the same effect. Like, we're seeing it molecularly. And as you pointed out, it is a defense mechanism. But I would say the biggest thing here is, like, everything you pointed out there, I think, is indisputable for most people. Like, we understand that that's what's happening. But the real question is it by design? And this is where we come to a very, very important distinction in our collective right now, in our ethos, is the people who are saying, look, this is by design, people. Don't you understand what's going on, how it's all connected? They're conspiracy theorists. And that's, you know, that's the label, unfortunately, as we know. And we know where that word came from, obviously. But the point here is that there's so much in common that we have with the people who are not conspiracy theorists. And I don't like to call myself a conspiracy theorist. I'm just calling myself a realist. And I call those people coincidence theorists. But nevertheless, we see what's going on, like, identically at one level. But when you go behind, we have a very interesting division between people who say, this is by design. They're trying to keep us hyperstimulated. They're trying to keep us busy. They're trying to keep us from asking the difficult questions and actually the most profound questions about who we are as entities and conscious entities. Whereas the other group, who are generally, you know, in our medical and scientific orthodoxies, poo-poo the idea. And, you know, that's another attack that my book makes against the orthodoxies in science, is there's very little that they can stand upon to say, no, there is no conspiracy here. But I think it's by design. I would imagine that you think it's by design too. Isn't that right?
Sure. I mean, look, I'll give you one example. Just look at all the research on 5G and electromagnetic frequencies. I mean, if you're an electrical engineer and you're doing that kind of research, All you got to do is look at a book like The Invisible Rainbow by Arthur Furstenberg, MD, who went to these telecom companies and asked to see the research that they wouldn't put in public, and they would not release it because it shows very, very damaging information. Yet in public, they say, oh no, that's a bunch of bullshit. Someone publishes a paper showing, for example, that non-ionizing EMF pollution can actually bother the body or disrupt systems. But meanwhile, they're burying all their own research so nobody can find it. I mean, you can't, you know, it's like drug manufacturers. You don't have the intelligence to create these drugs without knowing what kind of biochemical trickery and bombs you can be letting off.
Yeah.
You know, nobody builds a nuclear bomb without knowing what the ramifications of using it are. I mean, the whole point is to destroy things. So you don't go, oh, geez, we had no idea that was going to do that. So the point is, you know, like I interviewed Nir Eyal, who his book, I think it's called Hooked, which is all about internet addiction and how he himself got addicted to the internet. And you look at the book, the documentary, The Social Dilemma, and all the guys interviewed were the creators of social media, and they admit we let a dragon out of the box and we don't know how to get it back in. But just because the dragon's out of the box doesn't mean all these corporations aren't using this to their advantage. I mean, every single social media company out there pretty much is using the dopamine hit as a catch tool to make money off of it.
Look, I agree with you 100%, obviously. But let's slow down a second, because you brought up something very interesting, which was Arthur Furstenberg. And the question is, you know, why doesn't the scientific orthodoxy recognize what you just pointed out there? And I would suggest it's because they look at someone like Furstenberg and say, oh, well, he's a pseudoscientist. And this is their typical defense, is they use labels like that to dismiss what is very, very real and very trustworthy evidence, let's say. And this is a big problem because they are unable to see, for example, what gets published in peer-reviewed literature. That's being controlled too.
Oh, absolutely.
There's no, right? Like, you can't publish something that goes against the narrative. And yet we have all of these people who think they're so smart saying, well, show me peer-reviewed literature that demonstrates what you're saying. And when we say, well, look, you're not going to find it in peer-reviewed literature because they're not going to publish it. Oh, you're a conspiracy theorist. You really think that, you know, that science is being distorted? Yes, of course it's being distorted, obviously. But nevertheless, with regard to 5G, for example, you don't even have to read Furstenberg. If you go and look at the FCC and their recommendations with regard to, forget about 5G, 3G, which is in a lower band, they refer, you know, in terms of what is the safety recommendations for that level, that frequency of electromagnetic radiation, they refer to the FDA to get their statement on the FDA. And then the FDA cites articles that clearly show that in that bandwidth, rodent studies develop cancers. It's there, you know, you just have to follow the links. Forget about, you know, taking a third party position on this. That's what the FDA is using as part of their statement that yes, it's safe. And this is what's so interesting to me. Here's another sort of, you know, tidbit here. During the pandemic, I was working for Children's Health Defense. And for a year, I was their senior science editor for the Defender. And I was trying very hard to procure information and write articles that could be defended against the most fierce attack from the establishment. So I put a lot of time and effort into writing things that not only were robust, but that could be shared. And what I found was very interesting, because in that period, this is, you know, late 2021 and early 2022, papers were being published in peer-reviewed journals, and the conclusions did not match the results.
Are you surprised?
I was surprised. Look, you know, I'm slow to this. You know, I'm still like waking up to the fact, like, how deep does the rot go? And the point here
deep
is, yeah, all the way down, if you will. The point here is that their data shows A, but they conclude B. And one of the articles that I helped to write was like a compendium of position papers like that, where the results show this, but the conclusions show that. And of course, we know what happens, which is, journalists from the New York Times will say, oh, we have a new study that proves B, but they don't have the wherewithal to understand that actually the study proved A. And it reminded me of how we as medical students were asked to review scientific literature. And I remember going, how am I supposed to critique a scientist? Like, you know, I don't know anything about this. So I would read the abstract and read the conclusions. And although we were being taught to read the methodology and read the critique and read the discussion, it never made any sense to me. But suddenly I was in a position where that was required. And what I found was just so mesmerizing and disquieting, to say the least. But that's how they do it. And my theory or my hypothesis, which is, again, you know, I'm trying to be empathetic towards these scientists who are publishing these things. I am still holding on to the idea that they realize that they're being censored, that they cannot conclude what their data actually shows in order to get published. And my hypothesis is that they're trying to get the data out there so that the discerning amongst us will look and say, oh my God, that's what's really going on. And we can't prove it. But that's sort of my model around this. But in order to actually get to move the needle towards clarity, you have to get people who are willing to read the studies.
Well, guess what? Drew Canole is sitting here right here with me, and I'm going to try to sell him on Organifi's green juice. Drew, you got to try this stuff. My kids love it. I love it. And for a lot of people that are too busy to get good shop and find, you know, proper organic greens, it's the way to go. It's fast, it's easy, and it tastes good.
Yep. But
since you made it, why don't you tell everyone else about it?
Yeah. So one of the things that Organifi strives for is transparency in labels.
That's right? A good idea.
We almost have 4 grams of the greens, organic greens, and then 3 grams of the superfood blend. Not to mention 600 milligrams of ashwagandha.
Yes.
300 milligrams is the clinical dose for lowering stress.
Mm.
And when we're not stressed out, we don't crave food. Right,
well, you don't crave junk.
You don't crave junk. Yeah. And because you don't crave junk, it actually helps support weight loss.
Yeah.
So naturally, and this is the first green juice that was, you know, with the ashwagandha in it, and now it's glyphosate residue free. It's amazing.
You know what I like about this and all of your juice mixes of this style? One, they taste good. Two, I can get up out of my chair and in 32 seconds, I can have something that tastes good and feels good in my body and actually contributes to my mental stability and my ability to get work done or to my weightlifting or to my overall physiological adaptation to the stress of life.
Yeah, when we're stressed out, we don't produce testosterone as men.
Yes.
As much.
Shuts it way down.
So the ashwagandha helps with that. And one of my favorite mentors told me that it's a bioharmonizer.
It's a bioharmonizer, you know? For sure. We don't do biohacking around here. And that's why I love your products, because they are bioharmonizers. And that's what we all need, right?
So absolutely.
Thank you to Organifi and you for making such great products. I really love sharing them on my podcast, and my kids and my family use them daily. So this is the real deal. So if you want to get your green juice, you can go to Organifi, organifi.com/CHEK20. And on checkout, use the code CHEK20. Does it need to be all caps or does it case sensitive?
Doesn't matter.
Just CHEK20, get 20% off. And that's a damn good
family
deal.
Family discount.
And your whole family will be the better for it. And you'll enjoy the taste and feel good and know that you're doing something that your doctor won't do for you.
Absolutely.
Aho, great spirit.
Aho.
Aho. Thanks, buddy.
The CIA is on record for saying, in paraphrase, that when nobody knows what the truth is, our mission will be a success. And I've actually seen many documentaries and books and things citing this. When nobody knows the truth, common sense would suggest that nobody will have any tangible sense of reality. For a very long time, philosophers have been debating the nature of reality. So how do you define what reality is, and what do you feel the actual reason for all the propaganda is, and what the consequences we face because so many people lack a realistic basis from which discernment can be effective in their lives? Is that clear, or is that too many questions at once?
Mm-hmm. That's a very deep question, obviously. And
I'm hanging out with an anesthesiologist. I got to, you know, give it to you, baby. You put people to sleep, let's wake them up.
That's right. Well, you know, there's an aphorism in anesthesiology when people ask us, what are you going to charge for putting me to sleep, doctor? We all answer the same way. We say, that's free, man. We only charge you for the waking up part.
Yeah.
Well, my podcast is free, so you get to share some love back to all those sleepy people.
What is reality was your first question. And I would suggest that this is a dynamic process to define it. And that is, in fact, you know, why we're here, is the curious search for what is. And this is, I believe, is a very important aspect to trying to find a thread of reality when all of this distortion is being thrown at us. And I would suggest that the important point here is to embrace uncertainty and not run away from it with a quick conclusion, but to remain in a place where you are free to change your opinion. Because I don't think it's possible to know what is with 100% certainty. Because in order to know what is about anything, even like the smallest plant, if you want to know everything about the plant, you have to know everything about everything, because everything is connected.
Yeah, everything is everything.
Everything is everything. So let's be very real here. We have finite time and we have finite minds and capacities to hold ideas in our head. We're never going to get there. And actually, that's the reality, is that we don't know for sure. Now, that does not mean that we're fucked, because we can still put together an idea of how we believe the world works. And in science, uncertainty is recognized. Like every scientist that comes up with some sort of theory, they expect that it's going to be overturned at some point. That's what always happens. But there are a few axioms, and the axioms are not actually axioms. They're called laws, and we only have a handful of them. What's interesting about gravity, let's say, is we know precisely its effect if you know mass of two objects, let's say. But we have no idea why things move together. Like when you throw a ball up in the air, we know it's coming down, but we don't know why. And that is where we start from in science. You have to start somewhere in order to create a mapping of reality so that you can make sense of the world and do things. I would suggest, I'm going to go right to what I think is going on. I would say that the currency from a spiritual perspective, which is what we are as beings, we're spiritual beings, and our evolution is not technological or biological. Our evolution is spiritual. And the currency there is control. If we were to go down the path of these billionaires are behind a lot of what's going on in terms of the devastation and false narratives that are being put out, what are they after? They already have enough money that they can't spend in 100 lifetimes. They're not after money. They're after the control of our will. And, you know, I know that you've studied the law of one. That's something that I'm extremely familiar with. And given my background and what I've been exposed to as a child through my adolescence and young adulthood, and the readings that I've done in terms of Vedanta and, you know, spirituality from the Hindu perspective, the law of one to me is the most comprehensive and coherent explanation that I've ever heard.
Yeah, it's very good.
It's very, very good. And as a matter of fact, Jim McCarty, who is the sole surviving member of the trio that documented, transcribed, and channeled the Law of One, wrote the foreword to my book.
Yeah, I when I read that, I was surprised, because I was surprised he was still alive, because he must be getting pretty old by now.
Yeah, he's getting up there. But moreover, he's kind of a recluse, very devoted to his plants, and he still channels regularly, not Ra anymore, but other entities. And I sent him the manuscript 4 years ago, and I asked him, would you please read it? And he was very gracious, and he did, and he was willing to write a short blurb and for the book. And you know, he stated it well. The book is a primer. It doesn't take you all the way, but it's a way to sort of open doors to approach the problem that we have on the planet right now. To answer your question, I believe the currency is control. I mean, that's how Ra says it. And it makes sense, right? Because when you have attained that level of resource as an individual, you're not looking for more money anymore. You want to be able to control what people do and how they think. What we're seeing on the planet right now is very interesting. If you buy into the Law of One or the chakra system, Ra, for example, says that the transcendence that occurs when you go from what third density to fourth density has to do with the balance of how these energy centers are functioning. As we know, the heart chakra, the Anahata chakra, which is sort of the foundation for 4D, if you will, is the basic understanding of love in the universe. Above it in, you know, from the Indian perspective, it's called the Vishuddha chakra in your throat, which is the source of thought forms. It's above the heart. And what I'm seeing on the planet right now is the people who are engineering these disasters and have constructed these systems that we all buy into are using humanity to follow their heart to do the right thing while being controlled to do something that does not actually serve what they think it's serving. So it's very easy to manipulate billions of people if you give them the idea that what they're doing is actually the right thing to do. And, you know, we saw this during the COVID-19 pandemic. We were all told that we have to do our duty, our civic duty to get jabbed, to protect grandma or people who couldn't, you know, accept this therapy. And people were doing it religiously, and they, you know, they fought off people who were skeptics. It's very easy to just lose ourselves and say, well, there's nothing we can do, or I'm just going to do my own thing. But if we're truly interested in moving the needle towards clarity, we have to understand what we're up against. And we have to probe into the mind and how we come to conclusions and how easily we can be distracted.
Yeah, I'll throw a couple of things on the table. You know, if you want to explore reality, there's no better book than Reality Plus by David Chalmers. It's recently released. I've been studying it on audio. And he's a key researcher on consciousness, but he's also a big proponent of the fact that we're living in a simulation. He's also very pro virtual reality and all this other stuff. Makes a strong argument that we cannot discount things like virtual realities as real based on many different arguments. The problem is there's many things missing in his argument. So I'm hoping to get him on a podcast one day to see if I can put these things in front of him. But it does have a very comprehensive number of chapters in there on what reality is. I probably have 10 books in my library addressing that exact question specifically. I basically have two working definitions of reality. Reality is what your life depends upon. You have to have food. You have to have water. You have to have air. We need safety, security, warmth, and connection or love and relationships. So those are the realities that if we don't have, you can start to see that the individual or any number of individuals will break down. So when I'm thinking about reality, instead of getting all into the many, many philosophical head games that go on, I say, well, you know, we've got to look at what supports life. If you've got trees in a garden in your backyard, but you spend so much time interacting with trees on your cell phone that you forget to water the trees in the garden in the backyard, then life is diminishing. And if you live off, if you eat the food from that garden, you'll have no food because you spent too much time in a reality that is not essential for your survival. So I think it's very important for everybody to really consider that though there are many definitions of reality and a lot of hair splitting and a lot of what I call mental masturbation by philosophers, if your reality isn't connected with what supports life, then you're actually at risk of consciously or unconsciously making decisions that ultimately diminish your chances of survival and or even, let alone even if you're surviving, of thriving and, you know, not being an unhealthy person or struggling in life all the time. My other definition of reality is what's happening right now. You know, if someone drops something on your foot and it hurts, that's reality. It's happening right now. And is what's happening right now a departure from or support of that which is life affirmative? Because if what's happening right now is not supportive of life, we need to address it because it's a threat. It's a viable threat. The total number of hours being spent engaging social media and virtual realities is enough to cause tremendous psychological problems. We got the highest rates of addiction, alcohol abuse, drug abuse, medical drug abuse, obesity, depression, anxiety, and suicide. And all of those have been steadily on the rise since social media has become used in the public. And they're getting worse and worse and worse as we get further and further from what I'm defining as reality. And this goes back to the point that I'm raising, you know, it should concern every single, not only American, because the CIA is a worldwide problem, that when the CIA says its mission is to make sure nobody knows the truth, if you don't know what the truth is, and you don't know what reality is, you're basically somebody else's play toy, and you're probably on your way to a very uncomfortable life and a very uncomfortable future in which you have little control. One other point, there's a great book. I think everybody should listen to it. I'm going to interview the author as soon as I can. Kyle Kingsbury on the Kyle Kingsbury Show already interviewed him. It's called Controligarchs by Seamus Bruner. And it is the best expose of the top billionaires in the world behind all this stuff. And it is thorough. So Seamus Bruner's book, Controligarchs, does it really well. So does Vandana Shiva's book, Oneness Versus the 1%, which is a thorough dissection of Bill Gates and BlackRock and related issues. But she's taking it from the perspective of food, farming, and the soil, and many other things. One of the important distinctions you explore in your book is the difference between believing and knowing. Most people perceive that what they believe is what they know. Can you please distinguish the difference between believing and knowing and share why making a clear distinction in one's life is more important today than it's ever possibly been? As a therapist, I run into, you know, I'll give you a complete example of that. How many people got put on cholesterol lowering drugs and believe that they were at risk of a heart problem because the doctor said, oh, your cholesterol is too high, and believed it, but didn't actually know that cholesterol is good for you and that your steroid hormones are made from it, and that your genes depend on it, and it cleans your liver, and a million other things. And I've got studies in my library showing people, you know, like native populations and people like that with a total cholesterol of 1,000 that were completely healthy. There's must be 20 books written on the theme, the cholesterol hoax. So the point is, believing and knowing are two different things. Believing that what Anthony Fauci says is the truth and knowing the science is something completely different. And I think this distinction between believing and knowing is really, honestly, a death threat to someone who cannot make that distinction.
I agree with you 100%. And I think the best way to articulate the difference with this anecdote, which is in 2012, the National Science Foundation did a survey of American people. And one of the questions that was asked was, do you believe that the sun goes around the earth? Or do you believe that the earth goes around the sun? And not surprisingly, a lot of people got it wrong. You know, they believe that the sun goes around the earth every day. 25%, as a matter of fact, which is an embarrassingly large number. But, you know, then again, we're stuck watching TikTok videos. How do we know that? And I would suggest that the number of people that can actually explain to you how we know this is far less than 75%. Because it's not easy to know. And, you know, it doesn't matter if it's 1624 or 2024, you can't go outside your window and look up at the sky and know what's going on up there. And this is a very important distinction to make, because often right now we hear these stories about Galileo, for example, and his story is very, very interesting. And it needs to be explored a little bit, which is what I'd like to do right now. It is said that Galileo, you know, presented the first proof that we have a heliocentric solar system, a solar system where the sun is in the center. And that actually is not true. He presented a model. And what's fascinating about this is the person in Western society that first proposed a heliocentric solar system was Aristarchus, who is a Greek mathematician who lived around 270 BC. And he was allowed to pursue this model because it made calculations and predictions much, much easier. But at that time, he was not a threat to anything. People, you know, held on to that idea. And some people said, no, we're in the center of the universe. But then, of course, something happened, which is the, you know, advent of the papacy in the Christian church, which held that as the fact that the earth was the center of the universe as one of its basic tenets. And it also conferred a lot of authority to the papacy, because what good would it be if we were just a rock going around the sun like all the other planets? So there was some interest in maintaining the illusion that we were actually the center of the solar system and the universe. The point I'm trying to make here is that there are, once you can define how a system operates, you can then make much more intelligent predictions based upon the model. Because Occam's razor, for example, we cite that all the time. It's the most simple, the simplest explanation is the right explanation. You know, that's not a method of proof. That's just an observation. And you have to be able to account for all of the observations with your model, not just some of them. So the point here is that even though a an Earth-centered solar system was simpler and more elegant. It didn't prove it. You had to have the underlying forces, the first principles, if you will, first, before you could conclude that that's what happened. Of course, now we know that that's the case. We've got, you know, probes going out of the solar system and tons of satellite cameras.
I've had many people, students and others, try to convince me that the Earth is flat, the flat Earth theory. And I have a simple answer for that. Well, first I say, look out into the sky. Do you see any flat planets out there? Because I've never seen one. And there's powerful telescopes. I've never seen one on a telescope. But second of all, I'm a remote viewer. I can tell you, I can go out and look at the Earth, the moon, the sun, whatever you want. So the answer to the whole heliocentric versus Earth-centric is we have the ability. Most human beings have the ability to remote view. It's been taught now for probably 35 years. Without a long ado, anyone that really wants to learn remote viewing can learn it. That doesn't mean everyone's good at it, but there's thousands upon thousands upon thousands of remote viewers in the world now. But the reality of it is this points to another issue. We have innate potentials that are being subverted and are not being utilized. And, you know, you study the history of the Aboriginals. It's well documented. The Aboriginals could communicate for hundreds of miles using what they call song lines. And they would know exactly where to meet each other. Even after days and days of walking, they'd show up at exactly the right time. And Steiner said, I'm paraphrasing, men will continue to invent technologies outside of himself until he either destroys the world or realizes that every technology he's created outside of himself is an inferior copy of a technology within himself. And that's true. Okay, so the question is, are we going to destroy the world or are we going to learn to remote view, ask deeper questions, and utilize the innate talents that we have, of which are too many to even begin to get into? And that's one of the things for me that having a regular spiritual practice and working on things and practicing the stilling of my mind and, you know, using Tai Chi, Qigong, meditation, so that I actually have a means of establishing a sense of what is real for me based on my own living experiences, so I don't have to be subject to believing what other people tell me. Most belief comes by way of friggin' laziness. People are more willing to believe shit than they are to go ask, is it true, and do the work to find out if it's true. And when you pacify people with drugs and sugar and poison and media, they stop investigating to see if something is worth believing or if it's even true. And that is one of the problems that we have, because this whole dumb people down thing's been going on for a very long time. In fact, my grandfather was a school teacher for 35 years in Los Angeles School District, and my grandmother was the superintendent of the Redondo Beach School District. And my grandfather told me when he retired, he said, and I was probably only 13 years old at the time, he said, Paul, do you know that now, the year I'm retiring, that kids are graduating with an eighth grade education in high school? When I started teaching, they were getting a 12th grade education, but we had to keep reducing the standards because kids got dumber and dumber and the schools were getting so overpopulated, it was causing tremendous problems with young girls getting pregnant, with drugs, with violence, because we had 19 and 20-year-old people in the 12th grade behaving in a way that's not conducive to interact with high school students without all these kinds of problems. I'm sorry for the interjection, but you know, I'm just making the point. We've really got to distinguish believing from knowing. If you have any kind of further thoughts on that, I'd love to hear them.
I would say, to conclude, if you don't know how we came to our understanding of the structure of just say the solar system, then you don't know that the sun is the center of the solar system. You believe it. And that's a very, very important distinction to make. I'm not saying you're wrong, obviously. I'm just saying that you need to be able to understand where your understanding of reality is coming from. Is it coming from knowing, or are you trusting someone who has told you this before? Because being able to acknowledge the fact that you actually don't know, you believe, that opens up the possibility that you're wrong. And if you don't have that possibility, then your understanding of what is can never evolve. So I cite this as an example because this is something that people should be able to understand. If you didn't know, then you know how we came to that conclusion, you actually don't know, you believe. Like if you're holding the position, let's say that the earth is flat, okay? Ask yourself what kind of proof you would need to change your mind. And if you cannot come up with any kind of proof, like if you showed me evidence that this, that's different than saying, well, if you showed me X, Y, and Z, then I would change my mind. There's a difference between those two levels of certainty. You know, I would say that knowing is very rare. Like, for example, like when I'm speaking to my physician colleagues about the COVID-19 vaccine mRNA shots and their efficacy and effectiveness, ultimately, it comes down to a belief system because they will eventually say, but you know what, Madhava, the CDC says this, right? But you can't just take it, you know, at face value and block that whatever they say must be true. You have to look harder. And, you know, this is another reason why these other corrupt institutions like central banking, which makes us so busy, and the introduction of all of the social media, it makes it very hard to stop and say, well, let me go and actually look at the numbers. Let me look at the research. Let me look at both sides of the argument before coming to a conclusion. Most of the thought forms that construct your reality are actually beliefs. And you know, for someone like you who have these talents and have exercised this so you can know for yourself, you're in a very rarefied group of people. Because most of us are believing what we're told.
Hi, I wanted to jump in here and let you know that this year marks the 20th anniversary of the now iconic book that started it all, How to Eat, Move, and Be Healthy by Paul Check. This special milestone marks 2 decades of the book guiding individuals on their journey to holistic health. And in that time, we have brought out 2 editions, as well as versions in Swedish and Dutch. If you already have a copy, you will know that it is full of Paul's timeless and tested advice, and it has helped thousands of readers as Paul gets letters and emails from people all over the world. But did you know that the idea for the book came to him because he would have to repeat the same instructions over and over each time he took on a new client? So he decided to put his key coaching points into a book so he could help more than one person at a time. Fun fact, the book was initially going to be called Flatten Your Abs Forever, and the first draft was so long that the standing joke in our office was that all you had to do was lie on the floor with the book on your stomach and you would have instant flat abs. In honor of the 20th anniversary, I am thrilled to announce that we are releasing 2 exclusive versions of this book. The standard commemorative edition is perfect for first-time readers looking to discover the book for the first time, or those loyal followers who want to revisit it again. And for those who seek something truly unique, we present the Special Collector's Edition, an exclusive limited number with each book personally signed by Paul himself. Hurry, as both commemorative editions will be a limited print run. So to get your copy of the 20th anniversary edition of How to Eat, Move, and Be Healthy, go to check.group/eatmove20. That's check.group/eatmove20.
I used to sit and with complete and utter amazement, this is all the way back and early in my career, and read scientific articles published in medical journals saying that exercise would not help back pain. And I'm like, there's no way that I can be getting results like I'm getting. And so what I would do is I would deconstruct their research. And it was obvious to me they didn't even have a clue how to design an exercise program. They didn't know what type of exercises to use. And I could give you a long list of stuff. I've made a habit from my whole career, whenever I read so-called science that comes to a conclusion that goes against what I see from empirical evidence, I found by following the trail of how these people came to their conclusions that most of the time, the literature they cited to support their conclusion did not support their conclusion. But the point is, in order to really determine what you should believe versus what you know, you have to put some legwork into it. One must have a level of rigor and discipline
because today it is absolutely fucking dangerous to think you know something when it's just a belief that you haven't done the work to validate, and it can get you killed. That was my two cents on that.
It's one thing to have the curiosity and the wherewithal and the energy to be rigorous. And then you have all of these distractions thrown upon you, and you have this inability to make ends meet. It's getting harder and harder. There's no questioning going on at the level it should be happening. And it's just a very lazy approach to just trust. And look, if people want to trust, you know, different institutions, fine, that's fine. But don't tell me that you're being objective and that you have researched it. If you're just going to, well, the CDC says this, or, you know, something very interesting happened when I was in medical school, which is something called evidence-based medicine, which was an effort made by the medical orthodoxy to bring together large sets of data and to come up with guidelines for physicians. So two things happened. The first is, once you have large sets of data, it can make a more certain conclusion, but it also can be manipulated in many different ways to come to conclusions. But the more important thing that happened is that it detracted from a physician or a clinician provider's willingness to trust their anecdotal experience. Sort of coming towards the end of my career as a physician, most of my colleagues I work with are younger than me. They have, in some sense, divorce themselves from their anecdotal experience if it runs counter to the guidelines. And this is a very, very pernicious aspect to modern medicine, because now we are setting guidelines that are not necessarily rigorous in terms of their basis. And physicians, people who are seeing people, you know, with their own eyes, are doubting what they're seeing. I mean, there's no question that's what happened during the pandemic. Like, doctors everywhere have been seeing things they can't explain, but they're told that, well, it couldn't have been the shots. It must be something else. And I don't think this would have happened 30 or 40 years ago. Doctors would have been like, this is crazy. Of course there's a problem. You know, that's how we identify a problem with a medicine, is that, you know, there are anecdotal reports and case studies that get pushed up to the FDA, and then there's a review. Now, you know, doctors are, most of them are just sort of ignoring what they're seeing with their own eyes.
That's classic cult behavior. That's what happens when someone's indoctrinated and brainwashed. They don't see what's in front of them. They don't see reality. They see what they've been programmed to see, which only goes hand in hand with the entire discussion we've been having from the beginning about the dangers of what's going on. My next question is, the materialistic and now scientific materialistic paradigm is that we are our bodies and nothing else. The mind is a product of brain activity. The soul is an illusion people have bought into or is only programmed into them by religion. Can you share your conceptions in regard to the true nature of human beings and what some of the real challenges are that arise when one subscribes to the materialist belief that the totality of their being resides in their body?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it's something that I can speak to from my own experience as an anesthesiologist, having chaperoned 20,000 people to a state of, you know, deep unconsciousness and back. And in the context of not having a mechanism by which we can explain how anesthetics, inhaled anesthetics, work. And the answer is obvious. The reason why we haven't answered that question is because if you simply look at our paradigm, which is biochemical processes result in awareness, then you're now faced with a problem, which is, which structures then are responsible for your awareness? And our approach, our deconstructive approach, will inevitably lead to, you know, either areas in the prefrontal cortex or the brainstem, which are, you know, sources of awareness. But why? We're going to have to look at, you know, what's happening in those particular structures. What are the molecular interactions that result in something we call awareness? Is there a molecule? No, there's no molecule. I mean, can consciousness really be expressed materially? And the answer is obviously no. I mean, intuitively, we should understand that that cannot be. And the reason why this is so important, and to back that up, we have so much evidence that our consciousness is non-local. right there in the operating room, right? We have near-death experiences where someone is clinically dead by our standards, yet returns to life and remembers what was said, done in the proper sequence. Like, these are not interpretations of random firings of neurons in the brain that are interpreted post hoc. They remember everything. So, and usually it's from above. So clearly, and you know, you're a remote viewer, you know this, like you can bring your awareness to any place in the universe if you wanted to, but we see this in our own experience as physicians. And then we have this enormous amount of evidence behind reincarnation on this planet. You know, here I'm referring to Dr. Ian Stevenson, who is a psychiatrist at the University of Virginia, who's, you know, passed, but he documented thousands of...
I know of at least 2,500 cases he documented.
Correct. 2,500 cases of people who remember their past lives. And these are not people in, you know, that are 45 years old and claim that, you know, they were Cleopatra. We're talking about children from the time that they could first start forming words, told their parents about a previous life. And in some cases, rather than telling the child to keep quiet and don't make up stories, the parents were interested in these stories, documented them. And what's amazing is that Stevenson and his researchers found the family from which the child had lived in and died. And the child, when reunited, if you will, with these family members, can identify everybody in the family, their names, who is even identify the imposters that are brought in to see if the child truly can remember things.
And they even identified their houses. They knew exactly what the houses looked like, and many of them were still there. I know of one case, the kid knew he died as a fighter pilot. He not only knew the tail number of his airplane, he knew the names of the men on his crew and the name of the ship, and Ian Stevenson found naval records, and lo and behold, every single bit of it was there. And what was really trippy is in many cases, he's got pictures of these people in this lifetime, and when they find pictures of them in their past life, like this guy that was a fighter pilot, their bodies look so similar, it's crazy. It's really, so it really goes back to another metaphysical principle, is that the soul essentially creates the body that it wants for the mission that it's going to be on.
That's absolutely correct.
Yeah. I mean, like, there's just so much of this research. It's how could anyone like just deny this? This is like a mental disease to deny what is so obvious. It's like, are you kidding me?
Right. Yes, it is. It is. It's crazy how blind we are to what's right in front of us. And I believe Stevenson wrote another tome that talked about, you know, the like you mentioned the physicality of the new body, and very often the mechanism of injury in the previous life, a gunshot wound, for example, the child will have birthmarks at the same spot.
Yep.
Right.
Absolutely. Very consistently.
Very consistently. I mean, this is, like you said, more proof that our soul is giving rise to the body and not the other way around. But here's what's really interesting is if we were able to truly embody the idea that our existence does not terminate when we die, that doesn't mean that life is no longer precious. It is still very precious. It's a beautiful experience that one that needs to be enjoyed and learned from. However, that is the leverage point by which systems can control us. The fear, the absolute fear of termination. And this is why I believe there is a conspiracy, if you will, to not recognize this in science. Because if you have a population that is unafraid to die, they cannot be controlled. They can be controlled to some extent, but not completely. It's our connection to our body, our connection to the idea that this is all we have is what, you know, drives us to be fearful and also drives us to hold a competitive posture with everyone around us. Because if time is limited, then of course you're going to try to outmaneuver everybody else for a bigger piece of the pie. And we've created with our own thought system this kind of world where we're in constant competition and we're afraid. But the thing about reincarnation, and here I'm positing, of course I don't have any proof of this, but I believe that every advanced civilization at some point, like when they're in our density of consciousness or third density, if you will, by the law of one standards, comes to realize that they're reincarnating. It becomes obvious. And I believe that this is what, you know, this is the emergence of what Ra would call a social memory complex, is when when everybody comes to the conclusion that this is how it works, people. And so many things will happen when this happens. For example, if we know we're coming back, we're not going to make policy decisions based on a 10-year horizon or a 4-year horizon or a 2-year horizon. We're going to be looking ahead 2,000 years or 10,000 years because we are going to suffer or benefit from the fruits of our actions today. We're going to make completely different decisions. Moreover, all of the angst that we're feeling right now in terms of our identification with ethnicities and generational trauma, what if you realized that you were the ones that suffered back then, or you were the perpetrator 200 years ago? You were the slave owner. But at some point, a civilization will come to the understanding, it's like, why are we tormenting each other? Because we're suffering because we were tormenting each other back then and we're tormenting each other now. Let's realize that we're in this together forever.
Yeah. I mean, the Native American Indians and many Native cultures always had the rule, think about what you're about to do will do for 7 generations ahead. They're always thinking 7 generations ahead because of exactly this reason. Not so much from that most of them believed in reincarnation from my studies, but the point is, if what you're doing today is going to make it harder for your children to survive tomorrow, then you're making a deadly choice. And so here we are with a scientific materialistic paradigm making choices that are destroying the entire ecosystems of the planet and each other. And we keep doing this stupid shit as a world population over and over again, like Groundhog Day, but the planet itself can't keep playing this game because we've taken this thing, this ecosystem, to a point of near collapse. People need to think more about these things than what the next upgrade on their iPhone is going to be, or who's going to win the fucking Super Bowl, or you know, that kind of stuff. This is why I like the quote, never trust a man whose television screen is bigger than his bookshelf. It means he's spent too much time getting programmed and not really looking into the source of things.
Here, you and I are in agreement about what's happening, but we have no proof of that. I mean, you know, proof is subjective, which is very, very difficult to get by. But the point here is, given the fact that you cannot know, what paradigm are you going to subscribe to? And think about the implications of how you choose to live. As you said, we continue to pillage the earth without any regard to how our children are going to survive on it. So even though there are kids, we seem to take no notice of that. However, if we realize that we were going to suffer the consequences, that might be enough. But the point here is, given the fact that you have an option, you can choose how you want to regard reality or existence, why are you choosing agnosticism when it's clear that if we adopted the idea, the assumption that we reincarnate, of course we would be very productive and we would treat Gaia the way it should be treated, and we're not going to exploit each other. That's the obvious answer. Like, you don't have to have proof to realize that that's what's going to happen. And this is where, you know, it's important to see where your biases are and, you know, what is driving you to not do what's the obvious choice.
Hi, everybody. I'm sure grateful to have you on this journey with me and listening to the podcast and picking up new and interesting ways that we can all work together to make the world a better place for all living beings, now and in the future. Today, I'm really excited to tell you about Paleo Valley's new wild-caught fish roe. Have you ever tried wild-caught fish roe? I grew up on Vancouver Island, British Columbia, and each year during the salmon run, fish roe was plentiful, and when I'd eat it, I could just feel my body saying yes and wanting more. And that is exactly what happens every time I use Paleo Valley's carefully freeze-dried wild-caught fish roe capsules. Fish roe is an excellent addition to your daily health plan and is prized around the world by various cultures, containing an array of beneficial nutrients you'd get with whole food fish.
Paleo Valley's wild-caught fish roe comes from fish caught by sustainably minded fishermen committed to preserving fish runs for future generations, and it's super clean and healthy. It gives your body a great dose of easily absorbed omega-3 fatty acids, which are super important and helpful. In fact, a recent study found 68% of American adults are not consuming enough omega-3s, and 89% had levels in the dangerously low range associated with high cardiovascular risk. Omega-3 deficiencies can cause imbalances in the omega-6 to omega-3 fatty acid ratio, causing things like unhealthy levels of inflammation, low energy levels, poor memory, joint discomfort, dry skin, heart problems, mood swings, and even depression. Fish roe is rich in essential long-chain omega-3 fatty acids from eicosapentaenoic acid, EPA, and docosahexaenoic acid, DHA, which have been linked to less inflammation in consumers, improved cognitive function, healthy mood and mental health, better vision, healthy blood pressure, supported cardiovascular health, and strong immune function, and more. Plus, Paleo Valley wild-caught fish roe is enhanced with other additional compounds and nutrients such as protein, DPA, choline, selenium, vitamins E, C, D, B2, and phospholipids for added benefits. If you're interested in research to back anything I've shared here, feel free to reach out to Paleo Valley and they can help you.
To get Paleo Valley's wild-caught fish roe with all the benefits of omega-3 fatty acids and none of the fishy taste, and to get 15% off, just go to paleovalley.com/check15. You don't need a promo code, as your discount will be applied automatically in your shopping cart at checkout. That's paleovalley.com/check15 for a 15% discount on wild-caught fish roe.
There's an age-old debate in philosophy. Is it better to believe in God or not to believe in God? You know, and the reality of it is, if you don't believe in God, then death is screened to black and that's it. If you do believe in God, then there's all sorts of benefits from it. So if you don't know for sure, and you just have to make a choice, well, logic says go for the belief that's likely to produce the best results, because if you die and find out that you lived your life in a belief that was congruent with reality, then there's a reward for that. If you believe that there was no God and you died and find out you were wrong, you say, well, God, how did that completely alter the course of my life? You know? Yeah. So
yes.
If we have to gamble, then go where the odds are the best.
Right?
It's like, not that big of a tricky question.
100%. And we can say that you're almost insane if you don't do that. It's insanity. And, you know, this goes back to one of our first threads of conversation, is that the uncertainty is so important. We have to embrace it. We don't know, you know, like we're looking for proof where there is none. Like we don't have the ability to know for sure. And that actually, the mystery is what's so important about not only, you know, the wonder of life, but it also, I believe, has something to do with the karma that we will face. Because, you know, if it's spelled out, like if you do X, Y, and Z, you know, respect your mom, don't kill anybody, and blah, 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 you go to heaven, and you do those things, you know, you may go to heaven, wonderful. But you are under the belief, you know, you're certain that if you do these things, this will happen. That's a different kind of soul energy, a different vibration than someone who says, look, I don't know, but I'm going to do it anyway. I don't know if there's any payoff, but that's where I'm vibrating. I want to do whatever it takes to help humanity or to love people, even though I don't know if there's any payback. It's a different sort of karmic entanglement, if you will, when you take that approach with uncertainty as opposed to with certainty.
There's a very practical level of this very issue you've just brought up. I say, don't worry about whether you're going to go to heaven or not. Just pay attention to what happens every day of your life when you treat people with love and respect, and you have interest in their values, and you try to solve things in mutually beneficial ways, versus just saying, screw it, we're all going to die anyhow. I'm a fucking pirate. I'm going to take whatever I can get and piss on it. It's all going to be over in the end. If you don't believe that God is a living mirror, then just pay close attention to the events of your life and your part in them.
And then ask yourself, how in the world is that happening? How is it that my thoughts, feelings, emotions, and choices can alter the course, not only of my life, but everybody's lives that I touch, right?
You know, you're absolutely correct. And, you know, as we're talking about, you want to screw everybody over, or are you going to love? Now, let's apply that to the people we're up against, if you will, like the people that are stuck in status quo, the ones that don't understand belief versus knowing, the ones that dismiss all of this as, you know, woo-woo crap. I liken the situation to this, which is, let's imagine that you were on a river and you don't have an oar, but there's 20 oarsmen there, but they're all discoordinated in terms of, you know, moving together in a direction, and we're trying to get across the river, and you implore them to get coordinated, like guys, let's just go in this direction, but they're splashing around happily, not caring about what you want. And, you know, you can either scream at them, or you can say, okay, well, you know, let's just go in circles then, because you know what, I don't have any control over you. I'd like you to do what I want, but you don't want to do what I want. What happens when suddenly you see that the river is about to go over a waterfall? Now, how does this change how you want to speak or communicate with these people? Because I believe that we're in that situation right now. And I don't know what the answer to that question is, but I believe what's really important here, especially in the context of the metaphysics that we've been just talking about, is that deep in your heart and in your mind, you have to be willing to go over that waterfall and still love your oarsman. If you hold on to that, how does that affect how you interact with the people around you? Because that's actually the state that we're in right now. And it's, you know, it's worthy of contemplation, but in the end, we're going to survive the waterfall, maybe not in this body, but what, you know, what will happen next given your position and how your attitude around the situation? I think that's so, so key right now.
Yeah. Well, I think, and I've talked about this on many podcasts. I mean, if I was in the boat you're talking about, and exactly the scenario was going where people were just goofing around, and I said, look, notice that the water is disappearing off the horizon. And that means we're headed for a potential cliff, which means we may die together. So I have one question for you. Raise your hand if you want to die right in the next 10 minutes. Oh, you didn't raise your hand. Okay. Notice that we have two choices. There's a bank over there and a bank over there. Which one do you want to paddle toward? We all got to do it together, because if we don't start paddling now at the pace we're moving, we're not going to make it. So point, you have to have a common dream. And if you have a common dream,
you have to have a common dream.
Then you have an organizing force.
You're right. But the challenge we're up against right now is the people that you ask to look, they don't see the waterfall. That's the problem. That's what's so scary, is that they don't see it. And that, you know, is problematic, to say the least.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is great challenges inspire great creativity among those that are awake enough to realize that that's the best option. And I don't think it's going to take too many wise individuals to point out things that actually are true and helpful in regard to what we're doing, because as we get closer and closer to the guillotine, more and more people start to see the symptoms, right? Go back to your boat. The guys that say, well, you know, I'm not sure that's a waterfall, will have a different opinion in 250 yards when they hear the roaring sound of billions of tons of water hitting rocks. And they'll say, yeah. Oh, my God. So my point is, we're getting to the point now where no amount of media suppression is going to stop the truth from coming out. The question is, will we be able to paddle fast enough in the right direction? And will we be able to agree on what that direction is? But, you know, what an amazing tragedy, what an amazing comedy, what a full, rich drama. And Isn't it amazing that everybody gets to choose exactly how they want to play this thing out, for better, for worse, together, apart, materialist, spiritualist? And that, to me, is the grand mystery, you know, and that's that's what makes these conversations so amazing, because here we are saying, Madhav says, Paul, do you realize we're in a boat and there's a waterfall about 5 minutes from here and it sounds big? And I say, well, Madhav, I hear it, but do you realize these guys all got headphones on and they're listening to rap fucking music while they're smoking pot in this boat, and they all not only dropped their oars, but they dropped ours. So then I say, what do you want to do? Do you want to jump out and swim like hell? Or do you want to let these guys go over? Or do you want to see if we can wake these guys up with the last few seconds we have? So you see, there's always just choices all along. We get to find out about a lot about our character as a human being and a soul. If we say, fuck them, let's get out of here, they're too hard to wake up, then when we watch them go over the cliff, we have to say, did we try hard enough and deal with the pain of that? You know? Yeah. You know, so you play it out. I mean, to me, it's scary. I mean, I'm very concerned for my children's future and everybody's children's future. But at the same time, I know death is not the end. Mm-hmm. And the best I can do is really just do my best to wake people up in the boat and say, hey, you know what? I'd really like to include you in this choice. We've got a choice to make.
Yes, absolutely. Look, this is why this conversation is so powerful. And, you know, what you're doing is so amazing beyond, you know, your research into this physical and energetic structure we call our bodies, but like having a podcast, because this is an art form. A conversation now is like the new art form that is being, you know, projected throughout the internet. And, you know, there aren't a whole lot of conversations like this that are happening on the planet, but it's worthwhile to have. You know, this is why this is so important. And it's a lot of fun.
It is. I started a philosophy group many, many years ago. Penny and I were co-owners of the two buildings that we owned. We rented 6,000 to a Christian church. But it used to drive me absolutely out of my goddamn mind because I could hear their sermons right through the wall on Sunday. Mm. And I'm like, it hurts me to no end hearing all these kids and people being brainwashed into believing all this stuff that's so far from the truth that it just disgusts me. So the first thing I did is I went to that Christian pastor and invited him to my philosophy group. And I would go out and get the most deep thinkers I could. And usually every couple of months we'd get together for, you know, several hours at my big glass table in my library, and we'd choose topics and just have it out. It was just the greatest fun. I mean, you know, people would get right pissed off, but we always knew the rule was don't get so pissed off that you're not having fun anymore, or you're not mature enough to be in this room.
Awesome. I mean, we need more conversations with people we disagree with. That's actually another problem we're having, is that we're, you know, being driven to echo chambers, and that doesn't do any good.
Well, we're monoculturing people's minds, and, you know, all you got to do is look at what monoculturing does to nature to say, well, it's our nature too. You know, when you lose diversity of mind, you narrow your options for survival, period. And so deep thinking with deep people is essentially what held our race, our human beings together through tough times. That's what a chief is. There's a reason the chief has more feathers than everybody else. Every one of those feathers represents a level of knowledge and skill that person has. So, you know, if you want to have good conversations, you got to get a bunch of chiefs together. The problem is today we have a bunch of pseudo chiefs that hide behind fake qualifications and bogus educations that don't even understand that if your basis of reality is not what keeps you alive, that you're head fucking yourself and taking people for the ride.
You know, there's an interesting anecdote that was in one of Richard Feynman's book. I know you know Dick Feynman, right? Mm-hmm. The American physicist. I love his old lectures that are on YouTube, but I'm trying to remember what book it was, but maybe you remember this anecdote. He was talking about when he was on the Manhattan Project, and he was brought to a table where it was chaired by, I don't know, either Oppenheimer or Niels Bohr, like you know, someone of authority. And at the table were a dozen theoretical physicists, you know, the best of the cream of the crop, you know, they're on the Manhattan Project, and they had to come up with a solution to a problem that we're having. And the chair basically went around the room and said, okay, what's your idea? What's your idea? What's your idea? And everybody said, okay, everybody had a slightly or different solution. And when they were done, the chair was like, okay, we're going to go with Gelman. You know, no discussion, because everybody knew that that was the best answer. You know, that's what happens when you get very smart people in the room that have no ego involved and can see things clearly. The solution becomes self-emergent. And that's the way it should be. But, you know, we've got too much of our own crap in the way. And as you said, pseudo chiefs that are running the show. But, you know, sadly, I think most people believe that our scientific institutions, for example, are run by very intelligent people that can see clearly, and they really can't.
No, they see dollar signs. There's a very powerful saying. It's very hard to change a man's belief system when his paycheck depends on it. And that could be woman's belief system as well. But we're dealing with one of the greatest poisons and addictions and that ever is have been involved in humanity's life. And Jesus himself flipped over the tables on the money changers. And that's money. You know, money, that's why they say money is the root of all evil, because it magnifies the good and the bad with great intensity of any individual, right?
If you can buy an iPhone for X number of dollars, and they're being made readily available for very low cost because of the motives of getting people on them and the profiteering associated with it. I saw an amazing TED Talk, I think it was, a few years back, where a woman, I believe it was a computer, she actually broke down piece by piece what it cost to actually make that and where did the resources come from. And it was mind-blowing. She showed stuff in that computer came from the flesh of a pig. And it was like, by the time she finished, you realized that that computer that you were buying for X number of dollars was extracting a lot of real value out of the earth that was not being compensated for. So my point is when you use money as a means of valuing things, but you're not aware of the actual value based on what it takes to produce the resources in nature and how long it takes to regenerate the tree or the plant or the mineral. Like, how much strip mining are we doing of the planet to get stuff to make computer chips? It's unbelievable, right? That's one of the problems with solar issues. I mean, I've looked into this as well. We got a solar thing. We've got our house on solar. But as I looked into this, I'm like, okay, when you start looking at what it takes to make these solar panels, how long they actually last, and then what they end up doing is just ending up in landfills, the cost of those solar panels in the long run outweighs the benefits of using solar energy if you look at it realistically and you think, what's the ramifications 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, and 100 years from now? That we're in a very dangerous situation because we are not looking at the actual value of what we're buying with money. We're looking at a monetary value. And the only question is, can I afford it or not?
Yeah.
Right? Do I have enough money to buy that phone? And I'm saying, do you have enough interest in your children's future to ask whether or not buying that phone is actually leading us over the waterfall we were talking about earlier, or should we all put our heads together and find out better ways to communicate that aren't so destructive, that don't require strip mining and the use of sweatshop labor, dot, dot, dot. And I think, you know, this is one of, unfortunately, a long list of very important investigations that people are too sidetracked with relatively unimportant shit to look into. And I mean, Rachel Carlson wrote the book Silent Spring the year I was born, 1961. And within days, she was being labeled as a hippie quack nut job. And I actually 2 years ago or so read an article exposing all the attacks on her from big corporations because they didn't want people to actually be aware of what she was saying. And what Rachel Carlson said in 1961, today, it looks like a pimple on an elephant's ass compared to the size of the problems we got right now, mm-hmm. right? So here's just one example if you look at what someone that was very wise, very skilled, and used good science to demonstrate, and how she just got, propagandized and trashed like they do when they censor people, you realize this game's been going on for a very long time, and these are the people in the boat that won't paddle together because they don't give a shit about the waterfall because they're making so damn much money.
Yeah, well said, Paul. Yeah, along those lines, I mean, batteries. We seem to be consumed with this idea that everybody has to be driving an electric vehicle. And the amount of resources in terms of cobalt and lithium that goes into these batteries is huge. And we really have not come to a good understanding of how this is affecting the planet. And the true value, like the expense of cutting down the tree, the expense of creating a solar panel, obviously everything is underpriced compared to the real price the planet is paying.
Hi, everybody. I hope you're enjoying the show. I imagine you know that magnesium is one of the minerals that people in North America are the most deficient in, but it's an extremely important mineral to have in your diet regularly. And believe it or not, Bioptimizers has improved what was already well known to be the best magnesium formula out there called Magnesium Breakthrough. So I've got Wade Lightheart with me to explain what it is they've done to improve this already excellent formula. Wade, what is new about your new Mag Breakthrough formula?
Well, it's called sucrosomial magnesium. So we have seven different types of magnesium in Magnesium Breakthrough because they're uptaken by different parts of the body. But a new type of magnesium has been created called sucrosomial. And what it shows in the research and science is that it's actually even more absorbable by the body, particularly inside of the brain, which is a big aspect to enhance neurotransmitter formation, as well as ensuring the rest and relax response in the nervous system that a lot of people will take magnesium for. They find it, clocks them down, helps them sleep better, allows for the relaxation of striated and smooth muscle tissue in the body, which creates an energetic relief. And so when we added sucrosomial, we were able to demonstrate inside our lab facility that we were able to get better improvements. Of course, we have a partnership with the Birch International University. We have some patents we're working on, which will kind of relay some of these things. But sucrosomial was a no-brainer when we added to the formula, improved the results or improved the uptake. And the reports back from our testing team were like, wow, this, we get more results with less caps. And that's always the goal for our company.
That's excellent. I love it. I always say, and people have probably heard me say it before, I just am so amazed how you guys are constantly and always improving and working your best to not only make better products for us, but it doesn't seem to me that it gets more expensive as you make them better. So that's a real gift to the world. Thank you.
Bioptimizers offers Living 4D with Paul Check listeners 10% off Magnesium Breakthrough and all their other products. Plus, there are always amazing gifts with purchase. So to grab yours, go to bioptimizers.com/living4D and use the promo code PAUL10 when you check out. That's bioptimizers.com/living4D and the discount code is PAUL10.
So to shift the topic of our conversation somewhat, I'd like to explore the concept that we're not alone on this planet. Mm. I've had many conversations with very wise, enlightened people, including Andrew Kaufman, MD, a forensic psychiatrist, regarding who could ultimately be behind both the COVID pandemic, the WEF, the WHO pushing for one world government, and what is ultimately a scientific medical dictatorship. From my own investigations and many encounters with beings from other dimensions myself, I feel confident in my understanding that we're not alone and never have been. What are your thoughts on this regard, and why is it important for humanity to get clear on this issue at this time?
So you have the rare ability to know for yourself, true knowing in terms of, your communication with these beings. The problem is that most of us don't have that kind of direct knowing. And so we're faced with the idea that no amount of proof is going to be sufficient. Some people will look at a flash in the sky or a video with a shaky light and say, oh my gosh, it's clearly an ET or a extraterrestrial contrivance. other people can be abducted themselves and their minds still cannot accept the fact that there was an ET and they had a physical interaction with them. The level of proof is different for everybody. However, I would say the more appropriate and intelligent way to approach the problem is to look at how much effort has been made to prevent this idea from percolating through the ethos. And that should be a sign that someone somewhere is trying to withhold this information. And, you know, whether or not you agree with that, it's up to you. But the question would be, why do they want to keep this quiet? And I suggest that this is potentially the biggest secret, because I believe that if we were to accept the fact that that is in fact what's happening, I mean, like, we have enormous amounts of proof that ETs have been on the planet. I mean, we don't even know how that we built the pyramids, right? I mean, it's like beyond what we can do today, and we just attribute it to, you know, pharaohs and slaves using bronze tools. I mean, the absurdity of that idea. But the question is, why do they want to keep this from us? And my opinion is that inevitably, if we saw a extraterrestrial species on the planet, we would first have to, number one, acknowledge that somehow they got here. And whatever they used to get here would be something that would be very useful to us. Clearly, they're drawing energy out of space-time or, you know,
zero point, the field.
Zero point, exactly. That's something they want to keep secret. Perhaps more philosophically, the reason for withholding this information is that they would give us the example of what humanity would be capable of if we got our shit together. And that's, I think, potentially the biggest reason why they don't want us to see, like, what is humanity headed for. It's a beautiful, beautiful future if we were allowed to know and not be fooled and not be thrown into, you know, lifetimes of spent doing bullshit. The proof is different for everybody, but that should be evident, that that must be a reason. If there's a good reason why they're keeping it secret, that's a pretty good evidence that they're probably keeping the secret.
Yeah.
If you're someone that says, that's crazy, there cannot be ETs, then it doesn't matter how much evidence that you present that person, they're just going to blow it off like, well, that can't be because I know there are no ETs. And this actually is a very, very potent and ubiquitous problem in how we come to conclusions collectively. Because what we've done here is we've put the cart before the horse. Scientifically, you look at the evidence, you test it for its validity, and then you arrive at the conclusion. What we're doing with things that are hard to accept for whatever reason, our preconditioning, is we look at the conclusion first and we just throw it away. And so all the evidence makes no difference because you cannot accept the fact. And if we truly want to get to a place of clarity, we have to recognize when we're doing that. But this is something to approach our friends with and say, look, you're throwing it away because you can't believe it. You're throwing away all the evidence, but that's not actually, if you want to be truly objective, and claim that you're being objective, then you must do it the proper way.
I think it's just another example of, we're about to go over a waterfall. And if there are other beings more intelligent than us that could give us some solutions, you know, in a nutshell, I've asked a number of different types of beings and species and from different dimensions. I've always asked them this question. Are you aware of what is going on planet Earth? They always say yes. Are you aware of how seriously dangerous things are and how we're destroying the planet? They always say yes. I say, well, why are you letting it happen? And they all have told me the same thing. There is a universal council or a galactic council. And we have an agreement that we cannot disturb developing societies unless they're going to do something that is either going to completely wipe themselves out or it's going to damage other populations and communities throughout the solar system or the galaxy or otherwise, because then it's, for example, if you're watching your kids play with matches in the middle of a concrete parking lot, the worst thing that'll happen is they'll burn themselves. But if they're playing with matches in California in the brush in the middle of summer, they could wipe out a million people.
and not just burn themselves. So what I've been told is there are many populations of beings similar to or identical to human beings throughout the galaxy that are all at different stages of their evolution. And it's kind of like a school. You can't expect third graders to have 12th grader intelligence, but you have to create a container that allows them to minimize the likelihood of damage on a bigger scale. And so they then told me, look, here are some of the things that we have done and are doing. And if we hadn't done these, you guys would have been gone a long time ago. But you must figure it out.
Correct. Well, you know, look, I know we're winding down here, but and this is leading to a question for you. But like, I believe that what was inserted into humanity was the idea of elitism, that some people or some, you know, ruling families or emperors or whatever have a god or what a given right to choose for other people. And if you believe some of these extraterrestrials or, you know, Ra and the Law of One, they're like, yeah, you know, these are service to self social memory complexes that are looking to recruit, you know, a billion or now 7 billion, 8 billion minds into accepting their way of looking at reality,
yeah.
Right? And it's being done through these institutions. And you can call it the WEF, or you can call it the central banking system. You can call it the military-industrial complex. These things have all sort of arisen from a service-to-self extraterrestrial intelligence that has been on the planet for a very, very long time. And this should pose the following question is, well, why doesn't the Galactic Federation and these service to others, civilizations, come in and intervene? And because they also must abide by this idea of freedom. Like these Orion people or whatever you want to call them have the right to do whatever they want to. But I believe that they will not let us, they won't let them maraud us, you know, and just completely devastate us. And what seems sensical to me, which would explain some other things, is that they were told that if you can get humanity to go along with it by their own free will, then you can pretty much do whatever you want. And this is where the deception comes in, because we're being led into a place where we believe we're choosing, or we're being told what's going to happen. And because we accept it and we don't do anything, we then suffer the consequences of their machinations. And what I think is fascinating is that I think a lot of the things on the planet have been told to us, like, this is what's going to happen. Like, this is what we're doing. They're telling us. And, you know, like you said, we're plugged in to TikTok and we've got our headphones on. We're like, eh, whatever. But it's being told to us and we're ignoring it. And I would suggest that one of the biggest mechanisms for letting people know what is going to happen is Hollywood and film. And it's a very, very deceptive way, because, you know, as soon as we say, oh, you know, what was that movie about the pandemic? Can't remember, you know, came out 5 years before. And you're like, look, Hollywood told us that this is what's going to happen. Then you are faced with the immediate blowback, which is, oh my gosh, you believe in the movies? You take that seriously? And so we're stuck. So it's a paradigm.
Yeah. You know what, though? Consciousness cannot evolve without polarity. You can't have consciousness without polarity.
Yes.
You know, Edward Edinger's definition of consciousness, in paraphrase, consciousness is a psychic substance produced not blindly, but in living awareness of opposites. And I think if you go with the concept of reincarnation, and I've seen calculations that there is probably at least 3 billion Earth-like planets with environments similar to ours based on the mathematical calculations within the Milky Way galaxy alone. So in the scope of the universe, not that I'm at all for destroying the planet, but when you think of it, if the schoolhouse is as big as the Milky Way galaxy, which moving at the speed of light, it takes you 110 years just to cross the middle of the galaxy. I mean, 110,000 years. Yeah, moving at the speed of light. And that's one of only 2 trillion galaxies based on current estimations in the universe. So the Earth is really like a speck of sand on a vast beach And I think that what God is coming to know itself through every possible experience that can be offered. And since by definition, consciousness can't die, God can't die. And even if you're a scientific person, just take the word God out and put in pure potential, because we all know the energy, the universe is made of energy, information, and frequency. I mean, if you don't know that, you're not studying very much. So at the end of the day, there's obviously a process of evolution going on at every scale. And if you go to the reincarnation concept, it's kind of like, you know, you're a doctor. When you went into training, you had to go through mock exercises where someone's coming in with a heart attack, or you got someone that's got these symptoms. They ask you to diagnose the disease. What would you do about it? Mm-hmm. I think we're not doing anything other than being in school and being given scenarios, because ultimately, if you look at the scenario in the world right now, it boils down to this. There's about 385 global elites controlling 8 billion people. Well, think of ants. Ants are tiny little creatures, but you can trust me as a guy that knows. If you piss off an anthill or a hive of wasps and they come at you in numbers, you're dead. Okay. And so the reality of it is, it's not a question of, are they controlling us? It's a question of how long are we going to let it happen and say, okay, that's enough of this bullshit. We take responsibility for creating our own communication systems. We'll figure out how to heat our own homes. We'll develop education systems that don't brainwash kids. And when you think of all the geniuses we have amongst us, it's just a question of, are you more comfortable with the pain of letting everybody else keep you in the cave, Plato's cave, or do you want to go outside and start living? And do you have enough empathy and compassion and you to start doing things that ultimately, if emulated by others, increases our chances of survival, our chances of learning to live better, love better, grow, learn, and become more of what we're capable of being. And I ultimately, from the very beginning of COVID, I said, we're in our rite of passage ceremony. And I think we're going through a rite of passage in which we must take responsibility for our own sovereignty and for our own planet and for each other, instead of being passive and expecting somebody else to do it for us. My last question before we close, look, everything we've talked about is dangerously true. There's a lot of chaos, a lot of confusion. A lot of people are scared. Madhava, how do you, as a human being, as a man, navigate all this without just losing your center and becoming unproductive as a father, a husband, a doctor? What's your suggestion for people to make it through the craziness that's clearly present in the world right now?
You have to find your purpose. You know, a life without purpose is really not a life worth living. You're just going to be a useless eater otherwise. And that has to be defined very, very carefully, because that is going to be the map or the blueprint by how you value things, experiences and objects. You know, how does it fit your greater purpose? And we all have different ones. We're all, you know, we all have different talents, and we've come here, our own spiritual journeys have given us this experience. So, you know, pay close attention to that. Also, I really do believe that if you want to live an actualized life, you have to, as you've said and we've said several times, you have to make the effort. You must do the research. You must look at yourself. And there's no point in actually reading things and availing yourself of what is available if you haven't looked at yourself first. And this requires a contemplative practice. Otherwise, you can be misled by anybody. You know, you could read a lot of scientific journals and come up with the wrong conclusions because you have not actually looked at how you jump to conclusions. So I believe a meditative practice is absolutely essential. And none of these things would be possible if you don't take care of your body. That's something that I'm starting to realize now as I'm closing out my sixth decade. And you must be very careful with how much energy you put into thought. I think thought chews up a tremendous amount of energy. And unless you can replenish it with exercise and the right foods, what's the point?
Yeah. I mean, I could go on for at length about it. I've talked about it on many podcasts, but my tip for everybody, hold very still. Hold very still and use your heart to feel what you know. If you look at the research from HeartMath and IONS and many other organizations, it's clear that the heart has access to information well before the brain does. And the heart really is based on love and connection. And one thing relationships teach you is that bullshitting yourself and others in relationships always leads to pain. So we have an innate compass in our heart. That's why throughout antiquity, it's been called the home of the soul. And I think the best thing to do in these times is have a spiritual practice where you focus on your heart, visualize yourself breathing through your heart, practice loving in any way that feels safe, like imagining you're loving your cat, your plants, your car. But just practice centering your consciousness in your heart and relaxing so you can feel what it feels like to make love instead of waiting for someone else to do it for you. And when you get centered in your heart, your compass, your subjective feeling sense starts to have a magnetic north. And then you could start looking at things in the world through the eyes of the heart, which is a huge dimension shift from the eyes of the programmed ego mind or the head. And that's why they say the longest journey you'll ever take is from your head to your heart, but it's only about a foot. And I think if people today just spent some time each day practicing making love and filling themselves with love to harmonize themselves and bring their life force energy up, that they would be much more sensitive to when they're bullshitting themselves or bullshitting others. Because anytime you're deviating from the law of love or the truth of love, you're almost always deviating from what is life affirmative and from the truth.
That's beautiful. You're right.
Well, any closing comments, anywhere people can find you, your book, or anything you want to offer as we close?
You know, one thing we didn't really get into was 9/11, and I don't want to say anything.
I know.
But this is not your typical conspiracy theory. I think the reason why I say this, and I'm just going to implore your audience to really look hard at this, because this actually is, I believe, the thread that will let the entire thing unravel. Because most of us remember that day, exactly what happened, where we were. And once you come to the conclusion that I've arrived at, and so have you, that this was orchestrated by forces that are beyond our control, you'll understand how deep the rot goes. And hopefully it will encourage you to look hard at many other things. So I'm just going to say that. And my book is, you can find me on my website, madhavasetimd.com, where you can have a way to order the book. I have an active and growing Substack called An Insult to Intuition on Substack. You know, I write these things because it's called An Insult to Intuition because I'm writing about things that we should know better based on a heart-centered perspective, an intuitive perspective that we all have access to, a compass. And my work on Children's Health Defense, I'm no longer with them anymore, but you can find it there. That's all of the stuff about really, really rigorous evaluation of what we knew, what we know around the pandemic and the response and how it's being controlled. Yeah, so that'd be it. Thank you for having me on, Paul.
It's my pleasure. Thanks to all of you guys. I hope you enjoyed our dialogue. And I really recommend Madhava's book, Woke, An Anesthesiologist's View. I really felt like this is a book everybody should read, and that's why I wanted to do a podcast with you. And there's an example of someone putting their step a foot forward to really do something to make things better and educate people. And I think that's what we all can do. We can all do something in our own special way. Didn't have to be even writing a book, but just, you know, turning people on to good podcasts. I mean,
yep.
I mean, if it wasn't for people like Tucker Carlson, Joe Rogan, and others, we'd all be in the brainwashing machine. So share resources, Children's Health Defense, Green Med Info, whatever your favorite sources for higher quality news and information or science, etc. Share it. That's a great service. So thank you to the sponsors of the podcast for all your excellent products and supporting the podcast so we can support everybody else. Thank you for anything you buy from the sponsors. It's a little commission goes to the podcast so I can keep doing it. And I'm really grateful for all of you. If you've stuck with us this long, I know you're a committed student, and that means your chances of survival are higher. And I just want to say thank you guys for being with me and Madhava today, and lots of love, and I'll see you next Tuesday with another great podcast. Aho, great spirit. Madhava, thank you, buddy.
Aho.
Thank you for listening to Living 4D with Paul Cech and today's guest, Madhava Sethi. You can find Madhava and his book, Woke, An Anesthesiologist View, on his website at madhavasethimd.com. That's madhavasethymd.com. Read more from Madhava on his Substack site at madhavasethi.substack.com or connect with him on Instagram at splinterinyourmind. You can also find out more about Madhava's work for Children's Health Defense at childrenshealthdefense.org/authors/Madhava-Sethi-M-D. Catch up with Paul on Instagram, TikTok, and Threads at paul.check, on X at paulcheck, or on his YouTube podcast channel, youtube.com/living4D with Paul Cech. You can watch more on Paul's blog at paulcheckblog.com or visit the Cech Institute site at cechinstitute.com to find Paul's e-learning courses, advanced training programs, and to learn more about the Cech Academy. You can read the show notes and find links to the resources mentioned in this episode at cechinstitute.com/podcast. Again, a big thank you to our premier sponsors, Bioptimizers, Paleo Valley, and Organifi. We could not produce this podcast without their support. As you heard in this episode, all our sponsors offer special discounts for our listeners, so please visit the show notes page at cechinstitute.com/podcast for the links and details. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and a warm review on the podcast platform of your choice. This podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Audible, and YouTube.